This is Stuart Molina, music director of the Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra, podcasting from his home in Harrisburg. Today we'll talk about Matisse der Mahler, Hindemith's wonderful symphony, which we'll be playing this coming weekend in our Masterworks series. Before we talk at all about the music, it's important in this piece to understand a little bit about the political situation in which Hindemith was living, and also a little bit about the opera, the music of which inspired this particular symphony. This was written in the 1930s in Germany, and that alone tells you that it was a time of political turmoil. Particularly, it was a time of turmoil for Hindemith, being married to a Jewish woman, and being an artist in a time when artists were expected to celebrate the Nazi Party, which was rising in power. Needless to say, eventually, Hindemith left Germany. He escaped and came to Switzerland and then to America. But during this time, he almost poo-pooed the importance of the rise of the Nazis in his own life. But over the course of the first several years of the 1930s, it became increasingly clear that there were going to be problems for him. His main project of the time was an opera, Matisse der Mahler, about Matthias Grunewald. Matisse der Mahler means Matthias the painter. And Matthias Grunewald was a painter from the 16th century. His most famous piece of art is the altarpiece at the Isenheim church in Alsace. And this story tells his story, which is an artist who's doing very well, but is looking for greater spiritual enrichment. And so he decides to join the army, to join the peasants' revolt of the 16th century. But he finds in joining this revolt that the peasants commit as many atrocities as those that they're fighting. And so he leaves the army and goes into a solitary confinement, self-imposed solitary confinement in the forest. While in the forest, he has spiritual visions, which brings him back to a life of creating art, finding that the best way to serve God is to create art. So, in writing this opera, Hindemith, I think, was seeing himself, the artist, in a time of political struggle and political turmoil, and trying to create great art. It was Furtwängler, the great conductor, who convinced Hindemith to take material from the opera Matisse der Mahler and create the Matisse der Mahler symphony. Now, in doing this symphony, Hindemith no longer was really telling the story of Grunewald that he told in the opera, but rather each movement reflects on one of the panels from the great altarpiece at Isenheim. And so in the first movement, you have the angels concert. In the second, you have the entombment of Jesus. And then in the final movement, you have the temptation of Saint Anthony. But at the same time, Hindemith is using material from the opera. And so it does reflect, in a sense, on the action in the opera as well. So you have, in a sense, a symphony, which is a piece, within another piece, that also reflects on the reality of Hindemith's time living during the rise of the Nazis. The first movement, the Angels' Concert, comes from the beginning of the opera, the prologue of the opera, and it's a time of great productivity for Matthias and a time of great joy. The panel in the Isenheim altarpiece shows the angels performing a heavenly chorus. Again, very joyful, very spiritual, very bright, lots of smiling, lots of happiness. The piece Matisse der Mahler, the first movement, begins with kind of a set-up introduction, beginning with some very ethereal, very spectacular spiritual music, with just a G major chord in the strings punctuating a rising figure in the woodwinds. Then we hear the trombones in unison playing a song, an old German song called Es Zungen Drei Engel. There sang three angels. This is the melody. But Hindemith sets it against a very soft, very simple accompaniment in the strings, playing also in unison, and typifying Hindemith's sound. He uses open chords a lot, and a lot of open fourths and fifths, as well as, of course, standard major chords and minor chords. But in this particular case, you hear again this open chord feeling. We are in the key of G flat major of sorts, but again, as you'll hear in the accompaniment, it's a little ambiguous. And so on. The effect is one of mystery, again, of quite a lot of beauty and kind of this ethereal majesty. And as more instruments come in playing the Three Angels song and also the accompaniment, it builds in grandeur until finally the trumpets come in with the remaining woodwinds and you have a beautiful statement of this theme. So on, and then it winds down and the introduction comes to a close. The remainder of the first movement is a kind of a sonata form, although the recapitulation is not a standard recapitulation. You don't hear all the themes one after another as you did in the exposition. But you do get the three themes again actually playing all together. But the three themes are as follows. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the harmony and the structure of this piece beyond giving a little idea of the themes so that you can hear them as you hear the piece. The first theme you'll hear first in the strings and the flute. And again, it's a very joyful theme, very light, very happy. You'll hear that in Hindemith's melodies, a lot of the times, even though this is clearly a G major theme, he does change tonalities during the course of the theme. So you have the F natural gives it kind of this mixolydian sense, and then you have a switch almost to G minor. Strange. And then to C sharp major to C major. At any rate, all of that is incidental. It's a happy theme, the textures are light, and it builds and you get a playing around with this melody. And then a single horn will introduce the second theme. You'll have a horn remaining, and then this beautiful theme in F sharp major. It shifts in the middle from this F-sharp major tonality to kind of an E-flat major tonality, but it all seems very seamless. The closing theme, after this comes to its fruition through development, you'll hear in the flute with an accompaniment in the upper strings. Again, bright, cheerful, happy, with thin, glistening textures underneath. The development section of this piece comes in the form of a fugue. A fugue in the style of Bach. I mean, actually, clearly Hindemith has done his homework. He was one of the great contrapuntalists of his time, one of the great structuralists, and eventually taught composition and theory and wrote several books on the subject. So this is a man who knew his counterpoint, knew how to construct a fugue. And in this fugue, he uses both the first and the second theme, beginning with the second theme. And so on. But then, as the piece progresses, as the fugue goes on, he'll introduce our first theme. And so on. And so you have these two themes playing against each other in this fugue, again, building in intensity towards the middle section of our development. And in the middle section of our development, he'll bring our Three Angels hymn back, again in the trombones. But now, instead of the simple flowing triplet meter accompaniment, we have an accompaniment made of all three of our first movement themes. And I'm not going to even attempt to play it, but it kind of serves as the centerpiece of this first movement. And again, like the introduction, it reaches a grandeur towards the end of it, where the trumpets one more time join, and we expand, kind of augment the theme to be much wider, much slower. And then we return to the final theme with the flute. And this brings our first movement to a close. The second movement is called Grablegung, which means the laying in the grave, the entombment. The picture is a very dolorous, a very stark representation of Jesus's burial. And the music is appropriately somber, extremely staid. And he uses what's called a dotted rhythm, one, two, and three, four, and five. And so he sets this up at the very beginning, and it almost serves as an ostinato, meaning staying consistent through the entire second movement, or at least through the first large chunk of it. And this is what it will sound like. Again, listen for the open chords that he uses. Beautiful, very sad, very somber. And just in the fact that you have this rhythm repeating itself again, insistently, again and again, creates a power to this movement which is quite unique and quite wonderful. At the end of this opening section, the flute plays freely, setting up a second theme, which is equally stark. The accompaniment figure here is pizzicato strings, playing almost a heartbeat accompaniment, and the melody goes to the oboe and then the flute. This is what it sounds like. Similar to the opening theme in that you have a rhythm repeating itself insistently, but obviously very different in the sense of, instead of this rhythm being the entirety of the music, you now have a rather lyrical line that goes on top of it. Also a very sad, mournful melody line. Our opening rhythm will return. It will build and build and build. It becomes very exciting, powerful, but again, insistent in the repetition of the rhythm. And then what I find the most incredible part of this movement is the ending. After a big explosion of the whole orchestra with our ostinato rhythm, we now have, again, a simple melody in the woodwinds with an even simpler accompaniment, but this sort of reaching and grasping at something that can't be reached. I'll play a little bit of it. And so on. The piece ends quietly, sadly, almost filled with incredible unspoken grief. Again, appropriate to the panel. The last movement is the largest of the movements, by about three times in length, and it is the depiction musically of Matthias's depiction of the temptation of Saint Anthony. And in the picture, you have Saint Anthony being surrounded by these hideous, horrible beasts that are snapping and barking at him. And the introduction to the last movement sets up the scene. You have the ominous entrance of these horrible beasts growing in intensity, and then suddenly they snap at him, it's quite a terror-filled introduction. Again, very unique in the repertoire. It's a recitative for the strings to begin with, and in the second statement for almost the entire orchestra, and much of it is played in unison. I'll try to play just a little bit of it to give you an idea. After this introduction winds down, we have the main body of the last movement. And it's a movement that doesn't let up in its intensity, its terror. It's a depiction of the temptation of Saint Anthony. In the opera, it's music that is representing the political storm surrounding Matthias's life. And in reality, this is the storm that is surrounding Germany's future and the horrible present that Hindemith was living in at the time. I always find it fascinating to do music like this, where it's representing so vividly the horrible world in which some of these composers live. And just to think of a few examples, when we did Nielsen's Fourth Symphony, it was a similar kind of terror-filled piece. And the same with Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony and several other works of Shostakovich. This is no different. This is a piece that Hindemith is clearly reflecting in a very personal way on the ugliness surrounding him. I'm not going to try to play very much of this simply because it really doesn't translate well to the piano, but the music is very intense. Several different themes will emerge, and then he'll play rhythmic games on those themes. But what is important to know is that toward the end of this movement, he introduces an ancient chant, Laudation Salvatorum. And you hear it in the woodwinds against a very turmoil-filled figure that you've had in the strings for quite a while. And as more instruments join in the Gregorian chant, it almost takes over and calms the storm. This is also a typical thing that a composer will do in a piece like this, because hopefully most composers in the end are optimistic about man's chance of survival and the power of the human spirit and the artistic expression. In this piece, the hymn, the chant, takes over, and the piece ends in very dramatic, powerful way with a brass choir playing the Alleluia, and the piece comes to a very strong close, and I'll play a little bit of that. It's truly an inspiring, amazing work of art, a fantastic musical feat in every conceivable way. If you look on a microcosmic level, every phrase makes sense. The orchestration is flawless. But in a larger sense, it really has a powerful emotional impact, not just as a representation of these paintings in Alsace, but really as a representation of the artist's struggle and actually the human race's struggle against forces of terror and evil.